This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. Greetings to all listeners. And in today's show, we feature some interesting items sold relating to beer, belt buckles, and bare-breastedness. Our gallery and museum section highlights a health warning looking at art and dangers to objects themselves. And what are the protocols for nude modelling? Stay tuned, this and lots more will all be revealed. And let's kick off with a nice beer. And this comes from the Antiques Trade Gazette of the 13th of October. And it's entitled, When British Beer Cans Burst Into Life. Now, I know most people drink beer and worry less about the containers it comes in, but this article shows a very different picture. In the long history of beer, the can is relative newcomer. The first can beer came with the end of Prohibition in the US, the shiny new lightweight packaging used by Kroger's in Richmond, Virginia, to market a pasteurized beverage from January 1935. British ales were more problematic. Reacting with the tin in cold climate, the result was a metallic taste. It was not until Fallonfoil Brewery in Llanelli, Carmarthenshire, came up with the idea of coating the inside of the can with an inert wax that the taste challenge was met. For the family who owned Fallonfoil, the benefit was twofold. As well as being brewers, they were also Llanelli's tin plate masters, an industry which had taken a battering during the Depression years. With conical necks and pull-off caps, the first European half-pint beer cans from the 1930s bear little resemblance to the modern equivalent that would not emerge until the 1960s. And, as demonstrated by a sale held by Peter Francis of Carmarthen on October the 3rd, they are valuable collector's items. Included in this antiques and collectibles auction was a lot featuring three early Fallonfoil Brewery cans, two in red, black and silver livery with a dragon logo and another for a pale ale with a yellow ground. Despite the obvious condition issues, the three cans sold for £1,300 plus 24% buyer's premium. The buyer was the Fallonfoil Brewery itself, keen to add them to its museum. And that was written by Roland R. Kell in the Antiques Trade Gazette of the 13th of October 2018. But at nearly $3,000 all up, with buyer's premium, that's an awful lot to pay for a beer can, particularly when there isn't even any beer in it. And, as always, good old column 8 of the Sydney Morning Herald has got a beer story to add to our already read story, and this comes from December the 11th, 2018. But brush up your German language skills to understand this one. So column 8 writes, Who knew it was so hard for the traveller to get a drink? Bert Rosenberg of Rose Bay recalls, After a visit to a trade fair in Frankfurt, a colleague and I went for a drink at the Frankfurthof, a well-known hotel. I ordered a beer, and my friend ordered a dry martini. The drinks duly arrived. One beer and three martinis. And let's stay with this question of what things are worth, but let's turn to Lalique. Let's look at Lalique. Most commonly encountered is his glass. Here's another facet from the Antique Trade Gazette's Pick of the Week on the 1st of December 2018. Lalique buckle is auction belter. An unusual belt buckle by the Parisian jeweller and glassmaker René Lalique, which had been worn by the vendor throughout her nursing career, has sold for £19,000 at a North Yorkshire auction. And that's approximately $3,500 Australian dollars. The Art Nouveau-style silver and gold buckle, measuring 2.5 by 3 inches, that's 7 by 7.5 centimetres, was modelled in the form of a female face with flowing hair and a blue enamel headband. It had been estimated at £5,000 to £8,000 in tenants, who have a 20% buyer's premium, in the November the 17th fine art sale in Leyburn. It was featured on the BBC Antiques Roadshow, filmed at Castle Howard, broadcast on April the 22nd. The vendor had gifted the buckle by her uncle's great-aunt, who had moved to the UK from France in the 1890s. According to tenants, the buckle attracted attention from all over the world, and after many competing bids, finally sold to a bidder in the US. The wearable piece of art was made by Lalique. It's stamped with his name during the early part of his career. Lalique began his working life as a jeweller, designer, and by the 1980s had set up his own workshop and become accomplished at incorporating enamel and increasing glass into his work. It was only in 1907, after he went into partnership with a perfumer to create beautiful perfume bottles, that he made the transition to focusing solely on becoming a master of glassmaker, added tenants. Belt buckles are relatively scarce in the output of Lalique's career as a jeweller, and this charming example, which is pictured, certainly attracted collectors of Lalique and belt buckles enthusiasts. Well, that's a fairly expensive way to hold up your trousers. And now more on What's It Worth? Hello, hello. Do you remember the 1980s TV comedy by that name, starring Gordon Kaye and containing the immortal words, "I will say this only once"? So how does it get a mention in the Antique Trade Gazette of the 15th of October 2018? Well, here's how. Fallen Madonna makes big money. The Fallen Madonna with the big boobies, painting from the 1980s comedy Allo Allo, sold for a hammer price of £15,000 plus 18% buyer's premium against a £5,000 to £10,000 estimate at East Bristol Auctions. The prop, that was a running joke in the sitcom, was sold to a phone bidder in France. The buyer lives in the same region in the north where the show is set. Centred on a small town cafe in Nouvion in German-occupied France during the Second World War, the Allo Allo series plotline featured the work of fictional painter Van Klomp as a national treasure the Nazis were trying to steal. Thank you very much for that, Antique Trade Gazette. Let's raise another question. Is looking at art a health hazard? What does art do for you? How do you feel about the wonderful painting The Birth of Venus? I'm sure you actually know it. It's a naked beauty standing in a shell, covering her modesty with her hands and her long hair, and with a seascape behind. Most wonderful Botticelli painting. And here's what it did to one viewer. And this is a piece from Christina Ruth that appeared in the Art newspaper online. It was dated the 19th of December 2018. Heart-stopping. Man has heart attack in front of Botticelli. Beauty is in the eye of the defibrillator. An Italian tourist visiting the Uffizi galleries in Florence on the 15th of December had a heart attack while admiring Botticelli's sublime allegorical painting The Birth of Venus from around 1485. Four visiting doctors used one of the Uffizi's defibrillators on the tourist, who quickly taken to hospital and is now recovering. Museum director Eike Schmidt told the Corriere della Sera newspaper that there have been numerous such incidents. Somebody recently fainted in front of Caravaggio's Medusa, he said. And in 2016, another tourist had an epileptic fit in front of Botticelli's Venus. When asked if he believes the Stendhal syndrome, a disorder causing overwhelming feelings when viewing great works of art, Schmidt said, "I'm not a doctor. All I know is that visiting a museum like ours, which is so full of masterpieces, can certainly cause emotional, psychological, and even physical stress." Well, fortunately, there's no mention of anyone fainting in Australian museums. Let's now stay with galleries and museums. And what are the main difficulties museums face? Making ends meet? Preventing terrorist attacks? Theft? Well, here's another angle and another problem altogether. And this comes from news.artnet.com from the 6th of January. It starts off, here are 9 shocking times people destroyed art while taking selfies, ranked in severity. As we take a moment to look back on the past year, we couldn't help but notice that it was strewn with the shards of priceless art, all knocked over by clumsy tourists angling for better selfies. We wound up the most tragic cases in recent memory, ranking them on a scale of 1 to 5, based on the incident's shock factor, public visibility, age of the victimised art, and the potential for its restoration. And our first one is called They Went Down Like Dominoes. Background. At the Pop Art Gallery, 14th Factory in Los Angeles, a selfie taker knocked down almost an entire installation with such jaw-dropping precision you couldn't have planned it. There's even a YouTube video capturing the entire incident, which has racked up more than 7 million viewers. The victim? The installation consisted of a room filled with white pedestals set at varying heights, each with a different sculpture of a crown resting on top. Status report? According to Simon Birch, who founded the 14th Factory, the selfie fall cost upwards of $200,000 in damages. Damage factor? 4 exclamation marks. Our second one is Portugal's Pain. Background. In May 2016, after a midnight at Lisbon's Rosio train station, a 24-year-old man climbed up the decorative pedestal where a 126-year-old statue was perched, knocking the entire figure to the ground, whereupon it shattered. Victim? A statue of Don Sebastião, the Portuguese king who reigned in the 16th century. Status report? As of this month, a Portuguese tourism website takes notice of the missing statue and advises, nevertheless, even though there is no statue, don't be tempted for a photo here. Damage factor, 4 exclamation marks. And our third item, clumsy student meets drunken satyr. That's a half man, half goat in Roman mythology. Background. In March 2014, a student visiting the Academy of Fine Arts in Brera in Milan jumped on a 19th century statue's lap in an attempt to capture the photo, breaking its leg in the process. Victim? The drunken satyr, or Barberini's faun, circa 19th century copy. Status report? As the pictures show, the fauns would have needed serious surgical intervention to regain the use of his limb. Luckily, the now amputated sculpture was a 19th century copy of the original Hellenistic era piece. Damage factor, 3 exclamation marks. And our fourth item, they came in like a wrecking ball. Background, a quartet of young women visiting the Main Avenue Culture Center in the Urals city of Yekaterinburg, Russia, were vying to show off their best sides in a selfie when they bumped into a temporary wall, which crashed into works of art by Salvador Dali and Francisco Goya. Victim? A work from Francisco Goya's Los Caprichos series and the Salvador Dali's corresponding surrealist riff on the series. Status report? The show didn't close after the reckless visitors left, but both works suffered broken frames. Damage factor? 3 exclamation marks. Look, there are some more, but quite frankly, I think we've done enough damage there, and I think we might move on. But I would note that there aren't any records of anything like this happening in Australia yet, and let's hope they certainly don't. Let's turn to something slightly different. Nude modelling. Artists need nude models, male and female, to pose. So what are the protocols? Well, here are the main points, and this comes from the internet, news.artnet.com from the 30th of January 2019, and from Sarah Cascone. Do's and don'ts of working with nude models. 6 steps for keeping things professional. ArtNet News spoke with 2 nude models and the director of the drawing department of the New York Academy of Art, which relies heavily on figure drawing in its curricula and provides handbook outlining protocols to its roster of 68 models. From these interviews, we compiled a list of guidelines for both. 1. Do communicate up front whether or not the model will pose nude. Some of the women who complained about a particular artist said that they went to his studio with a belief that he would paint their face for a large-scale portrait. They were not expecting to be asked to take off their clothes, they said. Secondly, don't touch the models. That is the most important rule, says White. Don't move their arms to a different angle. Don't touch their face to change the angle in which it's tilted, she says. If you want a nude model to alter their pose, it should be described with words, or the photographer or artist can show them by demonstrating with their own body. Thirdly, do put the model's comfort before the artist's interest. Carla Rodriguez, a former intern at New York's 20 by 24 studio, an instant photography studio that works regularly with an artist on his large format Polaroid portraits, was invited to pose for the artist in 2008. She told Hyperallergenic that she was surprised when the artist asked her to undress beneath a spotlight in the darkened studio rather than in a dressing room. Having been a figure model, I'm used to being able to undress privately. It's mostly inappropriate to take your clothes off in the middle of the classroom, she said. Fourth, don't ignore red flags. I can't stress enough, if you're uncomfortable in any way, it's really important for you to say out loud, said White. Good people don't want you to feel uncomfortable in a work environment, so if they don't react well to you telling them you feel uncomfortable, then they aren't a good person and you're probably not in a good work environment. 5. Do decide what environment is most comfortable for you. Some situations may be strictly silent, such as the academy where students do not initiate conversations with the model, Grimaldi said. But model Kurt McVeigh finds such buttoned-up atmospheres stifling. That's why he got involved with the Artful Bachelorette, which hosts nude figure drawing classes for brides-to-be and their friends. He was struck by the amount of laughter in the room, which he found to be a counterbalance to the often pretentious New York art world, McVeigh told ArtNet News. And lastly, don't bring your cell phone. Posing nude for a drawing or painting is a completely different beast than posing for a photograph, and permission for one does not imply permission for the other. Because cell phones have the capability of taking photographs, along with the instant ability to post images on social media, students are notified that cell phone use under any circumstances is strictly forbidden in the classroom, Grimaldi said. The models are also encouraged that should they see a cell phone, they have every right to terminate the pose. Well, that's really all quite revealing. And it's important, but most of us might think it's just a question of good manners, really. Let's have a look at where to go and what to do. And here's something well worth doing. It's entitled Heaven and Earth in Chinese Art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. And it was sourced on news.artnet.com on the 8th of January. And under the heading of What? Because Taiwan has been concerned about mainland China's long-standing claims that they should be returning to Beijing, treasures from the National Palace Museum in Taipei rarely travel aboard. That's what makes this single-venue exhibition of 80 works, including the paintings, calligraphy, illustrated books, bronzes, ceramics, jade and wood carvings at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, all the more special. For the first time, star objects, including a Qing dynasty, that's 1644 to 1912, meat-shaped stone, will travel to Australia, all thanks to the Australian government's scheme to protect cultural objects on loan, which guarantees everything will be returned to Taipei's Palace Museum. Under the heading Where? Art Gallery of New South Wales, Art Gallery Road, Sydney, New South Wales 2000. And under the heading of When? February the 2nd through May the 5th. Well worth going to see. And now let's have a look at macaroni. If you went to the library to look for a book on macaroni, would you look in the cooking section? Would you find anything in the arts section? Well, here's a review of one book which would be in the arts section. Let's find out why. The book itself is called Pretty Gentlemen, Macaroni Men and the 18th Century Fashion World, and was written by Peter McNeil, Yale University Press, 256 pages, which is yours for £35. The review is by Hugh Besley and is called Macaroni Mania, Fashion as an 18th Century Window on the World. And it comes from the Art Newspaper, November 2018. Like the type of pasta, a shell without a core, a macaroni in the final third of the 18th century was also a very particular description of an urban fop who had been overly influenced by a taste for Parisian fashion. As we learn from Peter McNeil's study, it was not just fashion that determined a macaroni, but their manner of speaking, their deportment, and a genteel style of manners that they chose to adopt. Sporting an unusual cover of fleshy pink, there can be little surprise about the direction this book takes the reader. It starts with a study of dress which shifts during the 1760s away from the everyday worsted coat to extravagant brocaded silks, swords with elaborate sword knots in ribbed silk, or, for those with money burning a hole in their scabbards, burnished steel. Elaborate wigs with high toupee were a particular feature, and at their most extreme they resembled a washed-out imitation of the cap worn by contemporary grenadier guard. The long queue of wig hanging over the wearer's back was sometimes folded so that it resembled a bulky pillow bound in the middle. Often queues were covered with a black silk bag that sported an extravagant bow at the nape of the neck and protected the wearer's coat from wig powder. Begat by official dress worn by those attending the French court, these excesses soon took on a life of their own. Unsurprisingly, it was not long before these eccentricities became the subject of satirical prints, and husband and wife printers Matthew and Mary Darley had a peculiarly sharp eye for recording the phenomena. They produced six sets of 24 caricatures between 1771 and 1774, with titles such as The Miniature Macaroni, The Mungo Macaroni, and The Whalebone Macaroni. They were often associated with individuals. Sir Joseph Banks was shown as the fly-catching macaroni, the macaroni parson was the fraudster, the Reverend Dr. William Dodd. Richard Cosway was the macaroni painter, and early in his career the short, tubby Charles James Fox was given the title of the original macaroni. The Darley's prints provide a complete taxonomy, and McNeil's reproduces many of the images. The theatre also supplied comment on the 18th century hipster, not least in the guise of David Garrick, who dressed fashionably in civilian life and wrote plays, and appeared on stage as the most affected characters created by contemporary playwrights. Theatre not only aped the macaroni's style of dress, but also reflected the affected adaptations of language and mannered speech, perhaps a proto-Polari, that the characters adopted. The effeminacy of manners became the concern of etchers and mezzotinters, which produced more directional finger-pointing. Horace Walpole caused comment as he walked like a peewit, on tiptoe as if afraid of a wet floor, And it was argued in contemporary press articles that macaroni were indeterminate sex. Whether it belongs to the species of beasts or whether it is of the reptile kind, perhaps it's a species of butterfly. I have more sense than to call it masculine. And one illustration of a figure hatching from an egg was described as manhood's jest, a London macaroni. It was assumed that these characteristics had been encouraged by foreign travel, overseas manners, and the adoption of extreme fashion. McNeill's book is a social history that takes its evidence from fashion, print culture, the theatre, and contemporary attitudes to homosexuality. The reader's background will no doubt determine his or her response to the writing, but for the reviewer, the book sometimes betrays lacunae in the author's understanding of art historical conventions. It does provide an examination of a subculture that briefly put its head above the London parapet. However, in many respects, the macaroni were a flash in the pan, and by the 1790s they had been eclipsed by the Regency swashbuckling he-men so often described in the pages of romantic novels, such as Jane Austen to Mills and Boone. Macaronism was pushed back into the shadows, and ageing macaroni were described by the Bath-based author Christopher Anstey in his The Decayed Macaroni, a Sentimental Piece, 1790, as figures of ridicule and pity, and a stark contrast to younger men who favoured patriotic woollen garments rather than continental silks. Soon, the stereotypical excesses of Victorian attitudes, when men were men, women grateful, and pansies flowers, became the norm. There remains, however, one reference that is nonsense without an explanation of this book. The popular song, "Yankee Doodle came to town, riding on a pony, stuck a feather in his cap, and called it macaroni." As we learn from Pretty Gentleman, those throwaway lines manage to reflect all the nuances of affectation, pretense and delicacy, the spearhead of male fashion, manners and behaviour in the late 18th century Britain. And that was Peter McNeill's book, and it seems to be a fusion of food, fashion, fantasy and foppery. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.